what this money does is, after the program started, is allow us to turn the program over to the community, have them run their own program.
Money to help prevent suicide in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new race for mushers in Unalakleet.
Hopefully encourage those guys that want to get into mushing, give them something to look forward to.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, which has been providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at Primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at ArcticWireRope.com.
The state of Alaska has awarded the Center for Alaska Native Health Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks nearly $1.5 million to support rural southwestern Alaska Yupik communities in their suicide and substance abuse prevention efforts. The money will supplement a research program exploring how Alaska Native people are using ancestral knowledge and cultural traditions to promote well-being. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has more.
Billy Charles is the research coordinator for the program, which uses traditional ways to address high rates of suicide and alcohol abuse in Alaska Native communities in southwest Alaska. Charles, who's from Emonic, says the Native ways don't focus on the problem, and they're more holistic.
It's more of a reasons for living. It's a model used by our people for years, and it's real comprehensive. It deals with not only suicide, but the other things like high dropout rate, alcoholism, domestic violence.
The program just received funding from the state of Alaska through a capital funds appropriation. The award will not directly support research, but will instead be used to hire additional rural project staff, to develop a training center, and to bring the project to new communities and to sustain and expand prevention project activities over the next 3 years. Alaska has the highest per capita rate of suicide in the country. Nationwide, the rate of suicides among Alaska Native and American Indians between the ages of 15 and 29 is around double the national rate, and men are disproportionately affected. The program is based on the idea of the men's house, or kuskik.
Kuskik, the communal place, it's where men make decisions, also cleanse and bathe and song and dance.
Jim Allen is a professor of psychology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He also serves as the associate director of the Center for Alaska Native Health Research. He says the program comes out of years of collaborative research with rural Alaska Native communities, which produced culturally relevant activities that promote, as researchers say, protective factors.
For example, ice safety. As you probably know, the Yukon River in winter can be a dangerous place. And there are actually ways to read the safety of the ice, almost like a book. Color of ice, texture of ice. It'll tell you a lot about whether it's safe to walk on. Notice there you learn a value about always being aware of your surroundings and your safety.
Ice safety and other traditional activities serve as a metaphor for increasing self-awareness and self-care. The activities bring elders and youth together and build confidence. The money from the state will sustain such programs. Ellen.
What this money does is, after the program started, is allow us to turn the program over to the community and essentially have them run their own program.
Allen says he hopes the program will eventually serve as a model for programs throughout the state. UAF is currently partnering with 4 Southwest Alaska communities on the programs and plans to add 2 more soon. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
For rural Alaska mushers, the race season is starting to wind up. In January, there's the Kuskokwim 300 sled dog race. In April, the Kobuk 440. Now, in February, mushers will have another rural race in which to compete. The Norton Sound Sled Dog Club in Unalakleet is organizing the inaugural Paul Johnson Memorial Norton Sound 450 that will start in Unalakleet and end in Nome. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
The Norton Sound Sled Dog Club has been supporting dog mushing in the village of Unalakleet and the Norton Sound region since 1971. In 1973, the club started the Norton Sound Portage 200 from Unalakleet to Keltag and returned to Unalakleet. Well, this year, race teams will have the option to continue the race up the coast on the historic Iditarod Trail to finish in Nome. Already, reigning Iditarod champion John Baker is said to compete, and four-time Iditarod champion Martin Boozer, and sled dog drivers Dee Dee Johnrow, Aaron Burmeister, and Ray Reddington Jr. have shown interest. Iditarod veteran and race organizer Mitty Johnson says big names also come from Unalakleet. Three teams from the community have committed to the mid-distance race to Nome. Johnson said the Norton Sound 450 along the windy and often rough trail up the coast will give mushers the opportunity to scope out the trail to Nome before the Iditarod in March.
And what it'll do is it'll give even those that are not in dog mushing to be super competitive, it'll give them the experience to see what the coast is like before they run the Iditarod.
Johnson also says the Norton Sound Sled Dog Club has historically attracted mushers from St. Michael, Shektulik, Elam, Nome, and Teller to the Portage 200. With most mid-distance races on the road system, he's hopeful the Norton Sound 450 will be successful not just for the world-class Iditarod-type dog drivers.
Hopefully encourage those guys that want to get into mushing, give them something to look forward to, a race that's close to home, and maybe it'll help with the traditional transportation means.
The Norton Sound Sled Dog Club is working to get both the traditional Portage 200 and the Norton Sound 450 to be Iditarod qualifying races. The 450 will have a mandatory 8-hour layover in White Mountain with 16 hours of rest at any checkpoint along the trail. The Paul Johnson Memorial Norton Sound 450 is in honor of Iditarod veteran and longtime Norton Sound Sled Dog Club member Paul Johnson, who died of cancer in October. Mitty says his brother Paul was highly involved in the sport of dog mushing.
From trail grooming up to mushing to keeping mushers motivated, helping them get dog feed during the fall or the winter, he's just pretty much touched everybody in the sport of dog mushing. And if there was one person that went out of his way to do things for others, it was probably him.
The Paul Johnson Memorial Norton Sound 450 again will start February 8th at 10 a.m. in Unalakleet and finish in Nome. Johnson expects about 3 days later. The route will go to Keltag, return to Unalakleet, and run through the Norton Sound villages of Shektulik, Koyuk, Elam, Golovin, White Mountain, and finish in Nome. The purse totals $50,000 and will pay down to 15th place. Reporting in Unalakleet, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development last month finalized the federal definition of homelessness. The new definition reflects changing times. Now, households that have more than one family living under the same roof are eligible for more assistance from the federally funded programs. Monty Haver is the executive director for Kodiak's Brother Francis Shelter. He says the change is especially beneficial for homeless children.
So if we have a family that moved in with another family, which has been going on in Kodiak, while they may not be literally on the street homeless, they are considered homeless. And, you know, the reality of it is that while they may not be living on the street, it is a very poor situation to raise families in. Say, for instance, a 1,000-square-foot or an 800-square-foot Aleutian home with two families living in it, maybe five, six, seven kids and four adults. That's not a good situation. It's not a healthy way to live.
However, other changes aren't as favorable. Haver says now a family must be living at 30% or less of the federal poverty level to qualify for emergency assistance. Before, a family qualified at 50% of the poverty level. Also, the fair market rent for Kodiak went down, despite increasing rents on the island. Haver says both of these changes will make it more difficult for the Brother Francis Shelter there to help struggling families.
The main thing is that we don't want any families living in tents on hillsides or in cars or anything like that. We're blessed as a community having rid ourselves of that, including camps, and you know, the camps where families used to live down at the end of Shelikof, and that we've eliminated all of that in Kodiak, and we want to be able to hold that line, and it's difficult. It's more difficult this year than ever, I'll tell you that. More families are having a tougher time this year than I've ever seen it.
Hover estimates that about 25% of the families that the shelter serves will become ineligible for emergency assistance because of these changes. Still, he's hopeful that another source of funding will come through to fill the gap. The money is certainly needed as more families slip into financial uncertainty. A report released last week by the National Center on Family Homelessness shows an increase from about 5,500 homeless Alaskan children in 2006 to nearly 7,300 in 2010. That's a 30% increase in just 4 years. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, debris from the Japan tsunami is identified in Kodiak.
You might see one of those styrofoam floats once in a great while, but to see seven in a day, it's just unbelievable.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Governor Sean Parnell has budgeted money for a new state trooper helicopter in Fairbanks. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the allocation is aimed at improving search and rescue response in the interior.
It's been nearly 10 years since Fairbanks area troopers have had the kind of fast and powerful helicopter needed to quickly get to a search and rescue call and then bring injured back to a hospital. Troopers have been making do since 2002 when they had to decommission a helicopter due to airframe fatigue. Troopers have had to either rely on help from the military or call in the agency's only high-performance chopper up from Anchorage. Alaska Public Safety Commissioner Joe Masters says emergency responders always are racing against time, and they're hard-pressed to win that race when they first must fly up from Anchorage.
Time is a critical issue, and sometimes minutes mean the difference between somebody's life or not.
Dan Johnson with the Interior Region EMS Council in Fairbanks says a helicopter and trained personnel that can respond quickly to emergencies are badly needed in this area.
There's definitely a need for medical-capable search and rescue helicopters service in the interior.
Johnson says the problem became critical more than 3 years ago when the Army transferred a Fort Wainwright-based air ambulance unit to Afghanistan. Troopers have since then relied on an Air National Guard unit out of Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Johnson says the unit, the 210th Rescue Squadron, is top-notch, but it maintains only a part-time presence in the interior.
They're usually only located at Eielson Air Force Base Monday through Friday, and other days they respond from the Anchorage area. So that delays the response.
Masters has asked Governor Sean Parnell to include in his budget proposal about $3 million for a helicopter and another $300,000 to pay for a pilot and operational costs, such as leasing hangar space at Fairbanks International Airport. I'm Tim Ellis in Fairbanks.
A local beachcomber and renowned oceanographer have found that Kodiak is already receiving some of the earliest arrivals of debris from the Japanese tsunami that resulted from a 9.0 earthquake last March. The tsunami killed nearly 16,000 people and devastated 400 miles of Japan's coastline. Back in September, avid beachcomber Dave Kubiak came across a large white plastic float while out in his boat. Kubiak moved on, not sure if the float was actually from the tsunami, but then he came across several more, and then his friend, a fellow beachcomber, also reported seeing the floats.
You know, it's pretty obvious to me that something's going on, because you might see one of those styrofoam floats once in a great while, but to see seven in a day, it's unbelievable.
Kubiak's friend actually pulled a few of the floats and stored them in the back of his truck. They took pictures and sent them to Dr. Curtis Ebsmeyer. Ebsmeyer is well known for his study of flotsam and how it travels through the ocean. He sent the pictures to the national media in Japan and asked for help identifying the floats.
They were washed out in the tsunami from oyster grower farms. It's taken us since September when things first started arriving till the last couple of weeks to be really certain about it. We actually have quite a few buoys now that oyster growers have said, that's my buoy.
Ebsmeyer says debris will continue to wash up on shores from Kodiak to Oregon for the next few years. The ensuing reports from beachcombers like Kubiak will make for better understanding of how flotsam moves through the ocean.
This is unprecedented in recorded human history to have tsunami debris actually be able to be tracked across an ocean. These events have happened before, but we've never had people to actually watch it. This is a huge scientific event, huge in human history, devastated 400 miles of Japanese coastline. So we're dealing with just an immense event with hundreds of millions of tons of debris on the water. So the true dimensions of what's going on are probably not appreciated even now.
Ebsmeyer says scientists are already hypothesizing about the effects of mass amounts of debris traveling through the Pacific Ocean's currents. He points to an unprecedented number of sea turtles washing up on Vancouver Island.
Some scientists are saying that it's global warming. Another hypothesis that a friend of mine and myself are wondering about is if the tsunami had something to do with disrupting the migrations of sea turtles from Japan. They lay their eggs over there, and the small ones come this way. They ride the Japanese warm current. We're wondering if the debris, being so extensive, it's covering half the migratory route across the Pacific now. We're wondering if somehow that's disrupted their migration path. So that's a whole new dimension.
Ebsmeyer says people who find debris should be especially careful and respectful. Personal items and artifacts can still be reunited with people in Japan. He also suggests testing items for radiation just to be prudent. Ebsmeyer asks that people send him pictures and accounts of debris sightings through his website, flotsammetrics.com.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. Good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Atwood Foundation and Alaska Children's Trust.
The process to set federal fishing policy in the North Pacific relies on public input and sound science. That was the message that came out of a recent panel discussion held in Seattle. KDLG's Mike Mason was there and has the story.
The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council is one of eight such councils set up across the country to oversee federal fisheries. The council process was recently examined in depth during a panel discussion held in Seattle as part of last month's Pacific Marine Expo trade show. One of the participants in last month's discussion was Merrick Burden. He's the executive director of the Marine Conservation Alliance. While it's not unique among resource management organizations, the regional fisheries management councils, including the North Council, give great weight to the input of the public. Burden says that public input takes several shapes.
We have meetings that are held at several different locations throughout the course of the year in the affected region. We have the opportunity for the public to engage with decision makers on several fronts. In other words, you have direct access to council members if you go to a council meeting.
Despite the efforts taken to gather and consider public comments and input, the existing council process has come under criticism that they are dominated by commercial fishing interests, which in turn leads to decisions favorable to commercial fishing entities. During his presentation, Burden referenced a Marine Conservation Alliance Commission study a couple of years ago from the Institute of the North. It was an evaluation of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council's voting record on conservation issues. Burden says it specifically examined whether voting decisions were made based on financial interests or conservation interests between 1994 and 2006.
The study tallied the votes and noted amendments where they were introduced by other council members. then cross-check that voting history with the financial disclosure statements of the Fishery Management Council members. They then also compared those to the SSC recommendations about, in particular, tax setting or whatnot, and whether the North Pacific Council followed those recommendations. The two points that I pulled out of this that I think are most important are, one, that each action that was examined as part of this study imposed constraints on the fishery for purposes of conservation. Secondly, over the course of the review time period, the North Pacific Council had not ever deviated from the SSC's recommended overfishing level.
Another of the participants in last month's panel discussion was Washington State-based fisheries consultant Steve Miner. He's the managing partner for the firm Waterfront Associates. He claims there are three ingredients that make the North Council work: trust among the stakeholders, collaboration among stakeholders, and the use of objective science throughout the process.
The seafood industry and coastal communities of the North Pacific, Aleutian Islands, and the Bering Sea have enjoyed a decade of unparalleled achievement under this process. We've developed what people call the Alaska model. And up until a few years ago, the Alaska model, the way we were doing things, was held up around the world as the example of how to achieve sustainable fisheries.
Miner claims that some recent developments indicate that there is no longer widespread collaboration among stakeholders, which can in turn make the North Council process less effective.
I've asked myself a lot over the last few weeks what's created this general climate of anxiousness and discontent, and I want to suggest this: that the North Pacific Council process has a history based on trust, and trust requires both stakeholder collaboration and the use of objective science. Lose one of those things and you destabilize the process. Lose both and you begin to completely undermine it.
Miner says the trust and collaboration that he says makes the council process work is being impacted by a lack of trust among some stakeholders in the science used to make decisions.
Many stakeholders believe that the Stellar Sea Lion controversy, which has cost the seafood industry and coastal communities more than 700 jobs and $60 million in revenues, is the result in part of science that has been manipulated to support a predetermined political outcome. Whether it's true or not, that perception exists right now in our process. If science becomes suspect, trust begins to erode, and without mutual trust, collaboration begins to disappear.
The North Council just recently wrapped up their December meeting in Anchorage. The next meeting will be held from January the 30th through February the 7th in Seattle. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
In this last week of 2011, APRN and our member station reporters from across the state are taking a moment to reflect back on some of the stories that were significant for Alaskans. Today, we'll hear from the first three in our week-long series.
This is Ed Ronco from KCAW in Sitka. The best thing about my job is that people invite me into their lives, even if it's only for a few minutes. So back in May, I went to Pelican to do some stories on the town's economy. The economy there has seen better days. But while I was there, I met a guy named Norm Carson, who runs the local Chamber of Commerce. Back in the 1960s, Norm worked at the fish plant in Pelican, which used to employ scores of people. And when it closed a few years ago, the town's population dropped from a few hundred to just fewer than 90 people. I wasn't sure how many people would want to talk about what happened at the fish plant, and I was almost certain there would be no way to get inside. Norm made sure I did.
There's water on the floor.
I can't quite see.
And the roof is separated up above. So
the people I met in Pelican believe very deeply that the future of the place is bright and that the best days are yet to come. Norm Carson is one of those people.
There's hope. A small-scale cold storage, maybe a value-added fish processing here. Perhaps a fish hatchery down here at Pelican Creek.
You sound optimistic about a lot of the things around here.
Well, why not? I mean, just take a look at the country. It's a beautiful place to live, and why wouldn't you want to be here?
That was the first day of three I spent in Pelican, and just a small sample of the great people I met, all of whom, by the way, were willing to share their stories. I even made it to the famous Rose's Bar and Grill, where you can stand up on the bar and sign your name on the ceiling. You have to do it quickly, though, or Rose, at age 78, will pull down your pants. I wore snug pants, but if you look closely, you'll notice I definitely signed my last name a little more quickly than my first. This is Ed Ronco in Sitka.
I'm Matthew Smith from KNOM in Nome, One of my favorite stories of the year was the ongoing debate over whether or not to fluoridate Nome's water. After Fairbanks ceased fluoridation of its own water supply earlier this year and the fluoridation equipment in Nome broke down, the City Council and the Utility Board debated the merits of fluoridating the water at all. We covered this issue in news in an extended profile interview with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Chris Fish, who helps bring fluoridation to rural communities, and we also featured the issue on our Sounding Board call-in show. We heard a whole range of comments from listeners in our community, from dental workers with decades of experience who supported fluoridation, to staunch anti-fluoridation activists who said fluoridating water is a violation of the Nuremberg Code and medicates people without their consent. In the end, Nome Joint Utility accepted the offer by ANTHC. New equipment to fluoridate Nome's water should be in place pretty soon. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
This is Libby Casey, APRN's Washington correspondent. My mission here is to sort through the political battles and legislative lingo and figure out what it all means for actual people. One of those moments came last spring when I talked to a family outside Haines. Their 25-year-old daughter had cancer, and they wondered if the new national health care law meant she could stay on their insurance. Here's Jeff Bocart talking about his daughter getting sick.
It was quite a shock to all of us and the whole community because she really was health itself, tall, strapping gal who canned her own fish and did her own gardens and long been conscientious of what she ate. It was just one of those things that kind of showed everybody that this kind of thing can happen to anybody.
It turned out that because Bocard is a retired teacher, his daughter was not covered. Insuring grown kids isn't mandatory for state retiree programs, and Governor Parnell chose not to implement it because of cost. Their story took the political battle to the personal level and asked questions about what state and federal dollars should be spent on. There is a happy ending. The Bocart's daughter is now healthy and working on paying off her medical bills. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Tomorrow, we'll continue our look at 2011 with reports from Fairbanks, Dillingham, and Juneau. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Mike Mason in Dillingham, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Jennifer Canfield in Kodiak, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. We had year-end stories from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Libby Casey in Washington, and Matthew Smith in Nome. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Muskox Producers Co-op, whose Alaska Native members hand-knit Kiviut items. Information at www.kiviut.com, Q-I-V-I-U-T. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.